It's very good of you to see us at such short notice, Major.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I can't offer you a glass of sherry, I'm afraid. My wine merchant never recovered from losing all his stock in the Blitz. Cigarette, Monsieur Poirot.
Thank you.
You don't, I know, Claire. Mind if I light my pipe? Now then, what's all this about,
You may have read in the papers of the death of a man in the village of Walmsley Vale.
May have. Don't think so.
His name was Arden. Enoch Arden.
He was found in a room at the Stag Inn with the back of his head smashed in.
Oh, yeah, I do remember reading something about that.
I have a photograph. It is a press photograph. What we should like to know, Major, is whether you have ever seen this man before.
Wait a sec. Just let me get my spec. Now then, God bless my soul. Well, I'm damned.
You know the man?
Yeah, of course I know him. It's Underhay, Robert Underhay.
You're sure of that, Major?
Of course I'm sure. Robert Underhay, I'd swear it anywhere.
We've won, Lynn. Don't you see? Rosalind's marriage was invalid because her husband was still alive. She doesn't get Gordon's money. We get it.
It's ours.
The will that he made after his marriage is invalid. The one he made long before Rosalind came into his life still holds good, and that divides his inheritance between the immediate family. I get a fourth share. That'll set us up very handsomely.
Are you sure of what you're saying, Ray?
Of course I'm sure. It's elementary. If her first husband was alive when she married Gordon, she was never really married to him at all. So everything's all right. Everything's the way Gordon really meant it to be. It's as if that precious pair had never existed.
But what will they do?
I don't know. Go back to wherever they came from, I suppose.
But they won't have anything at all.
Well, yes, I can't help feeling sorry for Rosalind.
You rather like her, don't you?
Well, yes, I do, in a way. She's a nice kid. She knows a thing or two about farming, too.
It's more than I do. How do you know this?
She's passed by Long Willows a couple of times. We got talking. She was brought up on a farm in Ireland. Knows all about buttermaking and dairy produce. And she knows a good heifer when she sees one.
They were the same to me.
Oh, well, you'll soon learn.
But what about David?
Well, to hell with David. It was never his money anyway. He just came along and sponged off his sister.
He isn't a sponger. A bit of an adventurer, perhaps.
Why do you have to jump to his defense all the time? Still, he'll get what's coming to him.
What do you mean by that?
Who do you think killed Underhay? Hunter was here that day. He came down by the 5:30.
What time was Underhay killed?
I don't know exactly. We shall hear at the inquest tomorrow, sometime between 9 and 10, I imagine.
David caught the 9:20 train back to London.
Well, how do you know that?
I met him. He was running to catch it.
And how can you be sure he caught it?
Because he telephoned me from London when he got back.
What the hell did he telephone you for?
It doesn't matter.
It matters to me. I won't have him forcing his way into your life, coming between us.
Oh, stop talking nonsense. Anyway, it shows that he caught that train.
Well, it still gives him plenty of time to have killed Underhay. There's no point going on about David Hunter. The great thing is that now I can get Long Willow smartened up. I don't want you to have to pig it down there, old girl. I want it to be a proper home for you.
Yes, a proper home.
Well, you don't have to look so glum about it.
The inquest was held in the old corn market at Walmsley Vale, and I decided that it was time for me to take an active interest. All the clothes were there, and Major Potter, fidgeting and ill at ease. David Hunter and Rosaline sat by themselves. Beatrice Lippincott, wearing a distressingly bright green suit, reported the conversation she had overheard between Enoch Arden and David Hunter, and Rowley Claude told of his own interview with the man, doing his best to incriminate Hunter. But it was David Hunter himself who caused a real sensation in the court.
The first I knew of the man who called himself Enoch Arden was when he sent me a letter asking for assistance and stating that he had known my sister's first husband in Africa.
Do you still have that letter?
I don't keep letters.
You have heard the account given by Beatrice Lippincott of your conversation with the deceased. Is it a true account?
Totally untrue. She obviously couldn't hear much of what was said and invented most of it from her over-fertile imagination. The man simply told me a long, hard luck story and asked me for money.
Did he tell you that Robert Underhay was still alive?
No. He simply said that if Underhay had been alive, he would have helped him out.
Now, Mr. Hunter, did you visit the deceased again on the night of Tuesday?
No, I did not.
You have heard Mr. Rowley Claude say that the man was expecting a visitor.
He may have expected a visitor, but I was not that visitor. I'd given the man a fiver. I thought that was enough. There was no proof that he had really known Robert Underhay. Since my sister inherited a large income from her second husband, she has been the target of every sponger in the neighbourhood.
Then will you tell us where you were on that Tuesday evening?
Find out.
Mr. Hunter, that is a most foolish and ill-advised thing to say.
Why should I tell you where I was or what I was doing? Time enough for that when you accuse me of murdering the man.
If you persist in your attitude, it may come to that sooner than you think. You recognize this cigarette lighter?
Let me see. Yes, it's mine.
When did you have it last?
I can't exactly remember. Where was it found?
That will be gone into at the proper time, Mr. Hunter. You may stand down.
Next to be called was Major Potter. He stood to attention, as if he were on parade. But he seemed uncharacteristically nervous.
You have viewed the body of the deceased?
I have.
Can you identify the body?
Yes. It is the body of Robert Underhay.
You have not the least doubt of that?
None whatsoever.
When Rosaline Claude was called, I watched her with great interest. Major Porter looked at her too, but she did not even glance at him.
Mrs. Claude, I understand you were taken by the police to see the body of the deceased.
Yes.
And you stated definitely that the body was not that of your first husband, Robert Underhay.
Yes.
In view of the statement just made by Major Porter, would you like to withdraw or amend that?
No.
You still assert that the body was not that of your first husband.
It was not his body. It was a man I'd never seen in my life.
You are not under oath in this court, Mrs. Claude, but it is likely that you will be under oath in another court shortly. Are you prepared to swear that the body is not that of Robert Underhay, but of an unknown stranger?
I am prepared to swear that it is not the body of my husband, but of a man quite unknown to me.
You may stand down, Mrs. Claude. Quiet, please. We are here to determine how this man who called himself Enoch Arden came by his death. There can be no question of accident or suicide. There remains only one verdict, willful murder. And, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you now have to decide if there is any evidence as to whose hand it was that killed the deceased. You may think that the evidence points to a particular person, but a good deal of investigation as to motive and opportunity needs to be carried out before such a case can be made. If there is no such evidence, the best verdict is that of willful murder without sufficient evidence to show by whose hand. Such a verdict leaves the police free to pursue their necessary inquiries.
The jury were dismissed to consider what they had heard, and within 3/4 of an hour, they returned a verdict of willful murder against David Hunter.
I was afraid they'd do that. Local prejudice, of course.
It's premature, to say the least, and it hampers us. Do you know Monsieur Poirot? He was instrumental in bringing Major Porter forward.
Oh, I have heard of you, of course, Monsieur Poirot.
It is a very intriguing case. The story of Robert Underhay has interested me ever since I first heard it from Major Porter, nearly 2 years ago.
It raises some very curious points, of course. Underhay spoke of the possibility of faking his death and of returning under the name of Enoch Arden.
But would such a thing be admissible as evidence? Words spoken by a man who is now dead? But I must be on my way. Delighted to make your acquaintance, Monsieur Poirot. Mm-hmm. Goodbye, Superintendent.
Goodbye.
You're not happy about the case?
That Hunter chap worries me. You never know where you are with that sort. When they're innocent, they act as if they're guilty. And when they're guilty, you take your oath they were angels of light.
You think he's guilty?
Don't you? As far as the Claude family are concerned, Robert Underhay would be sent from heaven to restore the family fortunes.
I agree entirely.
Whereas Rosaline and her brother have every motive for wanting Underhay out of the way. And there's another point. After they both rushed off back to London...
That is one of the things that interests me most.
She goes straight round to Bond Street to sell some of the jewellery her husband left her. It looks as if she wanted a large sum of money quickly. In other words, she had to pay a blackmail.
And you call that evidence against David Hunter?
Don't you?
Evidence that there was blackmail, yes. Evidence of intent to commit murder, no. You cannot have it both ways. Either the young man was going to pay up, or else he was planning to kill. Now tell me, Superintendent, is there anything to establish the time of the murder?
The man's wristwatch was smashed. Mm. The hands were pointing to 9:10. Oh, I know it's a hoary old trick. Turn the hands of the watch to a time that suits you, smash, and work out your alibi accordingly.
And the medical evidence?
Between 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. Why are you taking such an interest in this case?
Oh, frankly, I do not know. Perhaps because of that strange conversation I had with Major Porter when I was only too grateful for anything to distract me from the bonds. I thought to myself then that something might come of the story he recounted, and something has come of it.
The unexpected has happened?
On the contrary, it is the expected that has happened. The wife remarries. There is a possibility that her first husband is still alive, and he is alive. He may turn up in the place where she is living. He does turn up. There may be blackmail. There is blackmail. The blackmailer may have to be silenced. Ah, ma foi, he is silenced.
Well, I suppose these things run pretty close to type. It's a common sort of crime. Blackmail resulting in murder.
Common? No, what interests me in this case is that it is curiously uncommon. More than that, it is all wrong.
How do you mean?
None of it is the right shape. And when I realize that, the little gray cells begin to stir. I tell you, my friend, this mystery is not at all what it seems. And we are very far from solving it.
Chief Inspector Japp always says you have a tortuous mind. How can a case not be the right shape?
The dead man, for instance, is all wrong.
What's wrong about him? Your Major Porter had no hesitation in identifying him as Robert Underhay.
Perhaps I am being fanciful, but consider this point. Underhay arrives at the Stag and writes a letter to David Hunter at Furrow Bank, which he receives at breakfast time the following morning.
That is so.
And the moment he reads the letter, what does he do? He bundles his sister off to London.
That's understandable, surely. He wanted to have a clear hand to deal with things in his own way.
And then he calls on Enoch Arden, and Beatrice Lippincott just happens to overhear their conversation, and what is clear beyond a shadow of doubt is that David Hunter is far from certain whether the man is Robert Underhay or not.
You mean, why didn't the man say that he was Underhay straight out? I don't see anything odd about that. Respectable people who are doing something a bit crooked like to preserve appearances. You've got to allow for human nature.
Human nature. That is perhaps why I am so interested in this case. In the coroner's court, I was observing the Claude family, all of them dependent for so many years on the power and wealth of Gordon Claude. And what happens, Superintendent? What happens to the ivy when the oak round which it clings is struck down?
Well, that's hardly a question in my line. And in any case, the Clodes don't have anything to worry about. Now we're certain the man was Robert Underhay.
Are we certain? Rosaline Claude says she has never seen the man in her life. After all, a woman should know her own husband when she sees him.
Even so, as far as Rosaline Claude is concerned, isn't it worth her while not to recognise her first husband if a couple of £1 million depends upon it? Besides, if he wasn't Robert Underhay, why was he killed?
That, Superintendent, is indeed the question.
A question I trust we shan't have to deal with. But you must excuse me, Monsieur Poirot. I must make my report to the Chief Constable.
I walked out into the little market square. In front of me was the Roman Catholic Church of the Assumption. Moved by I know not what impulse, I went in. A woman in a dark dress was kneeling, her head buried in her hands. Suddenly she got up and moved towards the church porch. It was Rosaline Claude.
Madame, can I help you?
No, no one can help me. They've taken David away to prison. I'm all alone.
No, madame. Not entirely alone.
You were there today at the inquest, weren't you?
I was, madame.
I'm frightened. David told me I'd be safe as long as he was there to look after me. He said they all wanted me dead.
Madame.
No, you can't help me. No one can. I've got to bear the weight of my wickedness all alone. I'm cut off from the mercy of God.
No one is cut off from the mercy of God. You know that well, my child.
I'd have to confess my sins.
And can you not confess? You came here for that, did you not?
I came to get comfort. But what comfort is there for me? I'm a sinner.
We are all sinners, madame.
But I'd have to tell. All the lies. All the lies I've spoken.
Lies about your husband? About Robert Underhay? Was it Robert Underhay who was killed?
It wasn't the body of my husband. It wasn't the least like him.
The dead man was not in the least like your husband?
No!
Then tell me, what was your husband like?
I'm not going to tell you.
And she rushed wildly out of the church. I walked slowly into the square and up the high street. In front of the Stag, I encountered Lynn Marchmont and Rowley Claude. He looked particularly pleased with himself.
I can't tell you how grateful we are, Monsieur Poirot. Conjuring Major Porter out of the blue like that. How you go about these things beats me. Anyway, it's going to make a lot of difference to our future married life.
How can you be so sure? There'll be all sorts of formalities to get through.
And when are you getting married?
In June.
And how long have you been engaged?
Nearly 6 years.
Lynn went into the Wrens.
And it is forbidden to marry in the Wrens?
I've been overseas.
Come on, Lynn. We must get going. I expect Monsieur Poirot wants to get back to town.
But I am not going back to town.
What?
I'm staying on here at the Stag for a short while.
But why?
Oh, c'est un beau paysage.
Well, I can't imagine what you'll find to do here. Wormsley Vale is a rather one-horse sort of a place. Good luck.
Monsieur Poirot, do you think they were right to arrest David Hunter?
After the verdict of the jury, the police had no alternative.
But do you think he did it?
Do you, mademoiselle?
Do come along, Lynn. We must get back.
Goodbye, Monsieur Poirot. I hope we meet again.
I went into the Stag to arrange a room for myself. And then I thought I would pay a call on Dr. Lionel Claude. His wife did not seem exactly overjoyed to see me.
Yes, well, I suppose you'd better come in. Everything's in a bit of a muddle, I'm afraid. Please take a seat if you can find one. Oh, let me move my Blavatsky there.
Oh, thank you.
You won't bring the word to my husband, will you, that I came and consulted you in London about the Underhay business?
No, my lips are sealed, madame.
I mean, I'd no idea that the man would actually turn up in Wormsley Vale that very same day. It was the most extraordinary coincidence.
It would certainly have been simpler if the Ouija board had directed you straight to the Stag.
Oh, the way things come about in the spirit world seems quite incalculable, but I do feel there is a purpose in it all.
That is very true. Even that I should sit here now in your drawing room, there is a purpose in that.
Is there really? Oh, yes, I suppose so. You're on your way back to London, of course.
Not at present. I am staying for a few days at the Stag.
At the Stag? Oh, but that's where... Oh, Monsieur Poirot, do you think that's wise?
I have been guided to the Stag.
Guided? What do you mean?
Guided by you, madame.
Oh, but I never meant... It's all so terrible, don't you think?
I have been talking to Rolly Claude and Miss Marchmont. They are getting married, I hear.
Dear Lynn, she's such a sweet girl. And Rolly is a splendid person, of course. But I think he became very bitter having to stay at home and look after the farm while all his friends were away at the war. And he used to get so angry when anyone suggested he was using the farm as an excuse for keeping out of it. Yes, he's got a ferocious temper sometimes. But it soon blows over. I hope he and Lynn manage to make a go of it.
6 years' engagement is a good test of affection.
Oh, I agree. But he must seem a little dull to a person who has seen so much of the world as Lynn has. Oh, but that's my husband coming. I hope he didn't hear me gossiping. Lionel, dear, here is Monsieur Poirot, who so cleverly brought Major Porter down to identify the body. It's wonderful, isn't it, how things do turn out for the best?
Even murder.
How do you do, Monsieur Poirot?
How do you do, Dr. Claude?
On your way back to London?
No, no, I remain at the stack for a day or two.
Oh, police want to keep you here for a bit.
Oh, no, 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 it is my own choice.
Well, I must go and get us some tea, and there may be a little seed cake left.
Does this mean you're not satisfied with the verdict? Got a feeling there's something wrong?
It is curious that you should say that. Do you feel that yourself, Doctor?
Well, hardly that.
Was there anything unsatisfactory about the medical evidence? Oh, I ask unofficially, of course.
No, I wouldn't say that.
But there is something you are not entirely certain about?
I've so little experience of police cases, you see. And anyway, medical evidence isn't the kind of hard and fast business that laymen and novelists seem to think. We're fallible. Medical science is fallible. What's diagnosis? A guess based on a very little knowledge and some indefinite clues that point in more than one direction.
Very like detection.
I'm pretty sound, perhaps, at diagnosing measles, because after all these years I've seen hundreds of cases. But I've known some queer things. I've seen a woman practically on the operating table ready to have her appendix whipped out and then paratyphoid diagnosed, just in time. Doctors, you know, are just as much victims of preconceived ideas as anybody else.
And in this case?
Here's a man, obviously murdered, lying with a bloodstained pair of fire tongs beside him. It would be nonsense to say he was hit with anything else. And yet, looking at his wounds, I'd have expected something rather different from fire tongs. Something with a more cutting edge.
Could he have fallen on some sharp object?
He was lying down in the middle of the floor on a good, thick, old-fashioned Axminster carpet. Anyway, the police surgeon was satisfied with the fire tongs, and, after all, he's the one that counts.
There was a cold east wind blowing, and I went back to my room at the Stag. But as I tiptoed up the stairs, I took the opportunity to peep into room number 5, where the man who had called himself Enoch Arden had died. There was nothing very remarkable about the room. A large brass double bed, an uninviting armchair, a heavy mantelpiece, and a solid marble fire curb with sharp square corners. It was chilly in my own room, and so I went down to the residence lounge. There was a cheerful-looking fire, and sitting beside it, a very formidable lady.
This lounge is reserved for people staying at the hotel.
I am staying at the hotel, madame.
But you're a foreigner.
Yes, madame.
In my opinion, you all ought to go back.
Go back where?
To where you came from. Oh. That's what we fought the war for, isn't it? Oh, I don't know what things are coming to. Oh, one good thing. They've closed down the aerodrome. It was disgraceful the way the girls right here used to go after the airmen. And what were they? Americans, Poles, oh, just riff-raff. Man, the girls are nowadays. faces covered in paint and powder, filthy stuff over their mouths, and bright red toenails.
Oh, yes, it is indeed deplorable, madame.
One of them put her head in here the other night. No hat on, hair tied up in an orange scarf and smothered in paint and powder. And what was she doing coming out of a man's bedroom, I should like to know? Disgusting.
Coming out of a man's bedroom?
Yes, that's what I said. Coming out of number 5.
What day was this, madame?
Oh, the day before there was all that fuss about a man being murdered. It's perfectly disgraceful that such a thing should happen here.
And what hour of the day was this?
Day? Which wasn't the day at all. No, past 10 o'clock at night it was. I was on my way up to my room, and out she comes from number 5 as bold as brass, stares at me and then dashes back inside again, laughing and talking with the man in there.
You heard him speak?
Well, that's what I'm telling you. Go on, get out of here, he says. I'm fed up with you. That's a nice way for a man to talk to a girl, but, oh, they ask for it, of course.
And you did not report this to the police?
I have never had anything to do with the police. Well, just imagine me, Emily Ledbetter, in a police court.
Ça, c'est la fin, eh? Funny how often you come back to the old formula. We did have an indication all along that there might be a woman involved. This lipstick was found under the chest of drawers in number 5.
Good quality. A dark cherry red, worn probably by a brunette. Were there any fingerprints?
None.
And you've no doubt made your inquiries?
Oh, yes. If there really was a woman, it makes the case against David Hunter look distinctly shaky. He's finally condescended to give us an account of his movements, by the way.
What does he say?
He caught the 4:16 from London and got to Walmsley Heath at 5:50. He walked along the footpath to Furrow Bank and collected various items he'd left behind. Letters and papers and a checkbook.
And when did he leave?
At around 7:25. He realized he'd missed the 7:20 and that there wouldn't be another train until the 9:20. So he went off for a walk.
In which direction?
Just a minute. I've got it all written down here. Down Copse, Bats Hill, and Long Ridge. And when he was up at Long Ridge, he realised he was cutting it a bit fine for the 9:20, so he haired off to the station and caught the train by the skin of his teeth. He arrived back in London at 10:45... and was back at the flat around 11.
And do you have confirmation of any of this?
Remarkably little. Roly Claude saw him arrive at Walmsley Heath, and Lynn Marchmont ran into him up by Marden Wood when he was running for the train.
Did anyone see him catch it?
No. But he telephoned to Miss Marchmont as soon as he got back to the flat.
That is checked?
Oh, yes. There was a toll call at 11:04, to the Marchmont number.
Very interesting.
So unless your old lady dreamt it all, Arden was still alive at 10:10. He was either killed by the woman who dropped the lipstick, the woman with the orange scarf, or by somebody who came in after she left.
And you are certain that Hunter was back in London at 11:04?
Oh, yes. Lynn Marchmont has confirmed that he spoke to her.
A meeting in Marden Wood and a telephone call later that same night. I should very much like to know what was said.
The human interest side of things, eh, Monsieur Poirot? Yes, it's a fascinating business.
It was getting late, but I had one more call to make on Jeremy Claude. While I was waiting for him in his study, on the desk, I noticed a photograph of an aristocratic-looking gentleman on a horse.
My wife's father and one of his best horses came second in the Derby in 1924. What can I do for you, Monsieur Poirot? As a family, we owe you a debt of gratitude for finding Major Porter like that.
Oh, the family seems very jubilant about it.
Oh, yes, yeah, rather premature to my mind. A lot of water's got to pass under the bridge yet. After all, Underhay's death was accepted in Africa, and Rosalind's evidence was very positive. Couldn't say how a case would go. But you wanted to see me.
I came to ask you if you are really certain that your brother did not make another will subsequent to the one drawn up at the time of his marriage.
I'm pretty certain that he intended to make one. The will he made when he married Rosaline was a very brief document, revoking all previous testaments and leaving everything to her. It was uncharacteristically offhand, the act of an infatuated old man, I always thought. But I'm sure he didn't make another before leaving New York.
He could perhaps have done it during the 2 days he spent in London before his death.
Or drawn it up himself, you mean? But who'd have witnessed it?
Well, there were 3 servants living in the house. They died the same night that he did.
That's possible, I suppose. But wouldn't it have been destroyed with the rest of the house?
It might have been in a safe. Would you at least authorize me to make inquiries in London?
Oh, certainly. Very kind of you to undertake such a thing.
Monsieur Poirot. I didn't know you were still in Walmsley Vale. How kind of you to call on us.
Monsieur Poirot is going up to London to find out whether there's any possibility that Gordon made another will before he was killed.
Seems a very outside chance.
I might consult the ARP officials. I understand that Major Porter was one of the wardens for that area.
Who exactly is this Major Porter? Was he really in Africa?
Oh, certainly, madame. Why not?
I don't know. He puzzled me.
Yes, Mrs. Claude, I can understand that.
What do you mean?
I must take my leave. I shall only be in London for 24 hours at most. Then I shall return to the Stag, where you will find me, if you want me.
But why should we want to find you, Monsieur Poirot?
I did not feel that I needed to reply to her question. In London, I found nothing. The house had been a total wreck and had been cleared away. But I was given the addresses of the next of kin of the 3 servants, the cook and butler from Dorset and the housemaid from County Cork. And then I took the opportunity to call on Major Porter. But there was a policeman standing outside the house, and in the hall was a very puzzled-looking Superintendent Spence.
How on earth did you get to hear of it, Monsieur Poirot?
Hear of what?
You mean you don't know?
No, what has happened? I simply came here to have a word with the Major.
I'm afraid that won't be possible. Major Porter has shot himself.
Huh? When did this happen?
Earlier this morning. They telephoned through to Walmsley Vale. I came up straight away.
Oh, the poor man. His conscience must have proved too strong for him.
Do you want to come up? He's just as we found him.
There is no question that it is suicide.
None whatsoever. Any idea why he should want to do it?
Yes. Oh, yes, there was a very good reason. That is not the difficulty.
It must have been about 3 hours ago. The woman of the house says he came back from the inquest yesterday in a terrible state. She heard him tramping up and down his room all night. She was out shopping when he did it.
Now, he seems to have been a neat and orderly man. Did he not leave any note, a letter for the coroner?
It's the sort of thing you'd expect a military man to do, I agree. But there was nothing.
It is very strange.
Bit of a blow for the Clodes, this. It'll set them back. They'll have to hunt about for someone else who knew Underhay. And I don't imagine that will be easy.
It was after 8 o'clock when I got back to the Stag, where there was a note awaiting me from Frances Claude, asking if I would call and see her. I went round straight away.
You said that I might want to talk to you, Monsieur Poirot, and you were right, of course. There is something that must be told, and I think that you are the best person to tell it to.
It is always easier, madame, to tell a thing to someone who already has a very good idea what it is.
You think you know what I'm going to say?
Oh, yes.
Since when?
Since the moment I saw the photograph of your father in your husband's study. The features of your family are very strongly marked, particularly in the man who came here calling himself Enoch Arden.
He was my second cousin, somewhat the black sheep of the family. I never knew him very well, but we played together as children. And now I've brought him to his death, an ugly, sordid death.
Tell me the whole story, madame.
We were desperate for money. That's where the story begins. My husband was in serious financial trouble. Disgrace, perhaps imprisonment, lay ahead of him. Still does, for that matter. You must understand, Monsieur Poirot, that the plan I carried out was my plan. My husband had nothing to do with it. I had already applied to Rosaline for a loan. I don't know whether, left to herself, she would have given it to me or not, but her brother blocked it. He was in an ugly mood and he was unnecessarily insulting, and that removed any scruples I might have had.
I understand.
My husband had repeated to me a rather interesting piece of information that he had overheard at his club.
Ah, yes, madame, I was there. Major Porter raised the possibility that Rosaline Claude's first husband might still be alive.
And it flashed through my mind that something might be managed by making use of that possibility. Charles Trenton, my cousin, was in this country and down on his luck. He'd been in prison, and I knew he wasn't a scrupulous person. I put the proposition to him. Of course, it was blackmail, neither more nor less. But we thought we had a good chance of getting away with it, and I didn't think that David Hunter would go to the police about it.
No, he does not greatly care for the police.
Charles could not, of course, definitely pretend that he was Robert Underhay. Rosalind would give that away in a moment. But luckily, she went to London, and that gave Charles the chance of suggesting that he might be Underhay. At first, David seemed to have fallen for it, but we should have known that he was a violent and dangerous person. And now Charles has been murdered, and but for me, he would still be alive. I sent him to his death. You can imagine what I have felt like ever since.
Nevertheless, your remorse did not prevent you from inducing Major Porter to identify the corpse as that of Robert Underhay.
No, I swear to you, I had nothing to do with that.
Huh?
We were dumbfounded when he gave evidence at the inquest. I still can't understand it.
But someone, and it could only have been one of your family, persuaded him or bribed him to identify your dead cousin as Underhay.
It was not I, and it was not Jeremy. Oh, I dare say you think that because I was ready to blackmail, I would stoop just as readily to fraud. No, Monsieur Poirot, I may have had no qualms about getting part of Gordon's money out of Rosalind, but I would never have tried to swindle her out of everything by manufacturing evidence that she was not Gordon's rightful wife at all. I could never do a thing like that, believe me.
Whoever did it will have it on their conscience for the rest of their lives. The Major shot himself this morning.
Oh, no.
Financially, he was in very low water, and when temptation came his way, he was unable to resist it. No doubt he regarded Rosaline Claude as a heartless little gold digger, and it might have given him satisfaction to put a spoke in her wheel.
And yet I couldn't help noticing he looked very unhappy at the inquest.
Au fond, he was an honest man, and very soon he would have to repeat his lie on oath. And his identifying the dead man as Underhay gave the jury a very potent motive to charge David Hunter with the murder.
He didn't say who...
He had his code. There was no reference as to who bribed him to commit perjury.
And so we are all back where we were.
So we are back where we started.
That, my friend, seems to be the general opinion. And now that there appears to be no doubt that Underhay died in Africa, Rosaline Claude's life is all that stands between the rest of the family and her husband's fortune. And she is afraid. Terribly afraid.
Do you honestly think that any of them would try to get rid of her?
I think this. Rosaline Claude is 26, and though mentally somewhat unstable, physically she's strong and healthy. She may live to be 70 or much more than that. 45 years, let us say, at the least. Now, do you not think that 45 years may be too long for someone to contemplate? No wonder the poor girl is afraid. She has reason to be.
I didn't realize you were still in Walmsley Vale, Monsieur Poirot. I can't imagine what you find so attractive about the place.
Oh, it is pleasantly out of the world. Here I can relax and smell the country air and exercise the little grey cells.
So what are you doing now?
Oh, I talk to people, mademoiselle. Pick up little pieces of gossip here and there.
What kind of gossip? I suppose you've heard things about me and Rowley and David.
But you are still going to marry Rowley Claude?
Am I? That's what I was wondering the night the man, whoever he was killed. I stood watching that train puffing up the valley, and then David burst suddenly out of the wood and threw everything into confusion.
Confusion about your marriage?
Oh, it's all so difficult. It isn't really a question of David at all. It's me. I've changed. I'm not the same person who went away.
But why did you go away in the first place?
I went to join the Wrens.
But why? You were engaged to be married. You were in love with Rolly Claude. You could have stayed on here as a land girl, could you not?
I could have, I suppose. But I wanted...
You wanted to get away. Perhaps you wanted to get away from Rolly Claude.
But when I was out east, I missed him terribly. I longed for home.
Yes. Where you are not, there you will want to be. What are your feelings about him now?
I wish I knew. I've grown too used to Rolly. And there's such a terrible anger in him now. He always had a short temper. But there are times when he looks at me like a mad bull.
Is that altogether surprising?
What do you mean?
I think you know very well.
You mean because of David? You think I'm in love with him?
Well, that is for you to say.
There's something in David that I'm afraid of. But there's something that draws me too. And I don't know whether I can really trust him. Can you love someone you can't trust?
Unfortunately, yes.
And there's been so much stupid gossip about him. People saying that he wasn't Rosaline's brother at all, but just an old boyfriend she palmed off on Uncle Gordon.
It is curious how people can get hold of the wrong end of a stick.
What do you mean?
Just what I say. Tell me, did Mrs. Lionel Claude ring you here on the night of the murder?
Yes, she did.
May I ask what about?
Oh, some stupid muddle over the coffee morning.
And did she speak from her own phone?
No, apparently it was out of order. She had to go out to a telephone box. She didn't have the right change, but fortunately there was a woman who was just finishing a call who was able to help her.
What kind of woman?
She was wearing an orange scarf. Aunt Kathy said she looked vaguely familiar, but then you know what she is. She said it must have been someone who passed over.
And at what time was this?
About 10 past 10. Our clocks don't keep particularly good time.
But that was not the only telephone call you had that evening.
No.
David Hunter rang you from London?
Yes. I suppose you want to know what he said.
Oh, mademoiselle.
Well, you're quite welcome to know. He said he was going away and clearing out of my life. That he was no good to me and that he would never run straight, not even for my sake.
Mm-hmm. And since that was probably true, you did not like it.
I hope he will go away. I hope they'll both go away to America or somewhere. Then perhaps we shall all learn to stand on our own feet again and stop feeling ill will and wishing Rosaline dead.
Her death is, of course, the only thing that can do you any practical good.
The poor girl looks like a ghost already, scared to death, living by herself in that great empty house, and she won't let any of us help.
Have you tried? You yourself?
I went up there yesterday, asked her if there was anything I could do. She just looked at me and said, "You least of all."
Huh? Why should she say that, mademoiselle?
I've no idea. Is it something to do with Rolly, do you think? She's been to see him at Long Willows, and I think he's the only one of us she likes. Could she be in love with him?
I have the greatest pity for her. If she would listen, I would try to help her. Come, let us make the attempt. Let us go to Furrowbank.
You want me to come with you?
If you are prepared to be understanding and generous.
Of course. Why don't we go straight away?
I'm afraid Madam isn't down yet. If you'd care to wait in the drawing room, I'll go and find out whether she wishes to see you.
A curiously impersonal room.
The whole house is like that. Uncle Gordon lavished money on the place, but he had no real taste of his own.
The wages of sin are said to be death, but sometimes the wages of sin seem to be luxury. Is that any more endurable, I wonder? To be cut off from one's own life, to catch perhaps a single glimpse of it when the way back to it is barred?
She won't come down. I know she won't. She doesn't want to have anything to do with...
Miss Marchmont! Something's happened to Mrs. Claude! She doesn't speak, and I can't wake her, and her hands are cold as ice! Come quickly!
She has been dead for quite some time. She must have died in her sleep.
Oh, sir. What are we going to do?
You must go and telephone her doctor at once. And you had better ring the police also.
The police? Yes, sir.
What is that box on her bedside table?
Powders of some kind. One to be taken at bedtime.
How many are left?
Three. And there's a paper here. She's written something.
Read it, but do not touch it.
I don't know what to do. I can't go on. I must tell someone and find peace. I didn't mean to be wicked. I didn't realise what was going to come of it.
Rosaline!
David, have they released you?
Rosaline. So, you've got rid of her at last. You sent me to jail on a trumped-up charge, and then, amongst you all, you put her away.
David, no!
If only they'd let me go 24 hours earlier. You weren't able to touch her when I was around, but as soon as she was alone, you saw your chance and took it. Well, you wanted her damned money, and now you've got it.
No, David, none of us would touch her. You know that very well.
I think perhaps that your assumptions are a little overdramatic, Mr. Hunter. Why jump to the conclusion that your sister was murdered?
So what do you call this? A natural death?
There is a note on her bedside table. No, no, do not pick it up.
You mean she killed herself? But why would she do that?
Supposing that last Tuesday night your sister wasn't in London, but in Walmsley Vale. Suppose she went to see the man who had been blackmailing her. Suppose that in a nervous frenzy, she killed him.
My sister was in London on Tuesday night. You know that very well.
Yes, Mr. Hunter. That is your version of events, and I dare say you'll stick to it. But whether it's true enough is hardly relevant now. The case will never come to court.
It is permitted, Superintendent, to ask you two questions?
Anything you like.
Those sleeping powders of Rosaline clothes, what were they?
Some kind of harmless bromide.
So what kind of poison killed her?
We haven't had the full results yet, but it looks like morphine, and a pretty hefty dose of it.
Was any morphine found in her possession?
No, none. What are you getting at?
I will pass on to my second question. David Hunter put through a call to Lynn Marchmont at 11:05 on the night of the murder. You checked up on all calls from the flat that night. Were there any incoming calls?
Yes. There was one at 10:15 from a public call box in Walmsley Vale.
And was that call answered?
I see what you mean. Yes, it was answered. So there must have been someone in the flat. It couldn't have been Hunter, since he was still on the train on his way to London. So it can only have been Rosaline Claude. In which case, she wasn't the girl in the orange scarf, and she didn't kill Arden. But if she didn't, who did? Rosaline Claude and her brother were the only ones with even a shadow of a motive.
Ah, the motive. It is that which has been leading us astray. If A had a motive for killing C, and B has a motive for killing D, it does not seem to make sense that A should kill D and B should kill C.
Go easy. I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about.
It is complicated because we have two different kinds of crime and consequently two different murders. Enter first murderer and enter second murderer.
Spare me the Shakespeare, for heaven's sake.
But this is a very Shakespearean mystery. Jealousy, hatred, opportunism. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune.
Look, Monsieur Poirot, why can't you say what you mean?
I will be very clear. We have here, have we not, three deaths. But how did these people die?
Well, you know the answer to that. One murder and two suicides. Though the second suicide is beginning to look like a second murder.
According to my way of thinking, there has been one accident, one suicide, and one murder in that order.
Accident? But the man's head was beaten in with a poker.
When I say there was an accident, I mean that there was no intent to kill.
You mean he was attacked by a lunatic?
I think that is very near the truth, though not quite in the sense that you mean it.
And did this same lunatic kill Rosaline Claude as well?
By no means, no. This is where first murderer makes his exit and second murderer enters. Quite a different kind of crime. Cold and deliberate and passionless. And I intend to see that her murderer hangs for it.
You've got to give me more than this to go on, Monsieur Poirot.
Just as soon as I receive responses to the telegrams I sent off yesterday.
What kind of responses?
I have asked the next of kin of the three servants who were killed in the blitz with Gordon Claude to send me the victim's photographs. That will give me all the evidence I need to bring the murderer to justice.
It's no good, Lynn. I can't pretend anymore. That night I phoned you from London. I meant to get out of your life, but it's no good. I was a fool to think I could leave you behind me. You know as well as I do, we were made for one another.
Yes, David, I do know. I've tried to fight against it, but it's simply no use.
I'm not going to give you the chance to fight against it anymore. We'll go to London and get married by special license. Don't trouble about Rowley. We'll break it to him when you're actually Mrs. David Hunter.
You're going to marry David Hunter? Why?
Because I love him.
Oh, no, Lynn. You love me.
That's not true any longer, Rowley. I did love you, but then I went away. It's been 4 years and I've changed. We've both changed.
You're wrong. I haven't changed, Lynn. I haven't been in the war. I missed my chance of fighting for my country because I had to stay here and run the farm. I've seen my girl dress in uniform and go off overseas. I've been the man she left behind her. My life's been hell. Don't you understand? Then you came back, and I had to sit and watch you and Hunter making eyes at each other across Aunt Kathy's table and meeting out in the garden. And now you say you're going off with him.
Yes.
Well, he's not going to have you. If you're not for me, then nobody shall have you.
Rowley!
I've killed two people. Do you think I'd stick at killing a third? He's not going to have you, Lynn.
I hope that I do not intrude. I knocked, but no one answered. Perhaps, Mr. Claude, you could go and boil us a kettle and make us some coffee.
Look here. I don't think you understand. I was trying to strangle Lynn.
Two lumps, if you please.
I've got two deaths on my conscience already. Hers would have been the third if you hadn't arrived.
Let us drink our coffee.
How much do you know? Do you realize I killed Charles Trenton?
Perhaps we should continue to call him Enoch Arden. Yes, I have known that for some time.
Lynn, your mother told me he'd come here. What the devil's the matter with your throat?
Another cup for Mr. Hunter, if you please, Mr. Claude.
Yes, of course.
Sit down, Mr. Hunter. We shall drink our coffee, and you shall all three listen to Hercule Poirot while he gives you a lecture on crime.
Here's your coffee.
Thanks.
I can't believe this is really happening.
From the very beginning, I asked myself this question. What happens? What happens when people who have been protected from real life suddenly find that protection taken away from them virtually overnight? Most of us learn to stand on our own 2 feet early in life, but this did not happen with the Claudes. When their protector and benefactor was taken from them, for the very first time they were forced to look life in the face.
And we didn't much care for what we saw.
All that stood between them and the safe and happy existence they had taken for granted was the life of one person, Rosaline Claude. The thought of her death passed through all their minds, of that I am certain, and the possibility of murder also. Did you think of killing her, Mr. Claude?
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact. She came past the farm one day, out for a walk, she said. There was no one else about. She looked pretty and rather pathetic, like the calves I'd sent off to market that morning. I thought how easy it would be to kill her. It was in my mind when I took the lighter from her to light her cigarette.
Ah, so that is how you got hold of it.
Yes, I forgot to give it back to her.
And yet you did not yield to the temptation of killing her in cold blood. It was not your sort of crime. The man you did kill, you killed in a fit of rage, and perhaps you did not really mean to kill him.
No, I didn't. I punched him on the jaw. He went over backwards and he hit his head on the marble fender. I just couldn't believe he was dead. But how did you know?
I think I have reconstructed your movements fairly accurately. Beatrice Lippincott told you of the conversation she had overheard at the Stag, and you went straight to your uncle Jeremy Claude to get his opinion. But while you were waiting for him in his study, something caught your attention. A photograph, perhaps.
A photograph of Francis's father. And there were other pictures of her family in the room, all with the same characteristic features. The features of Enoch Arden. I realized that Francis must have got one of her relations to pretend to be Rosalind's first husband and to try to get money out of her.
God, what a despicable bunch you all are.
I went straight to the Stag and up to Arden's room. I told him he was a fraud. He just laughed at me and said that David Hunter would be coming across with the money later that evening. He wasn't just double-crossing Hunter. He was making a mug out of me as well. Well, I saw red and hit out at him.
And it was then, perhaps, that you realized you still had the cigarette lighter.
Yes, I knew it had Hunter's initials on it. It seemed too good an opportunity to resist.
Did it really?
I dragged the body into the middle of the room and picked up the steel tongs.
Oh.
I won't go into details. I wiped off my fingerprints and cleaned up the marble curb. I put Arden's wristwatch forward to 9:10 and smashed it. I wanted to give myself an alibi. And I took away the man's ration book and his papers. I didn't want anyone to trace his identity.
And then you came and asked me to find someone who had known Underhay. Oh, such a pretty little comedy. And I fell for it. I was the complete mug. You already knew what Major Porter had told me that night during the air raid, because the whole conversation had been overheard by your Uncle Jeremy, and he had told you all about it.
Yes, that's true.
But although it took me some time to realize it, Major Porter gave you both away. He offers me a cigarette and says to you, "You don't, I know. Imbecile that I am. I should have realized the truth then." You had already been to see Porter and made your little arrangement together. He would be given a share of the money as soon as Gordon Claude's marriage to Rosaline had been declared invalid. Unfortunately for you, Major Porter had a troubled conscience.
I should have realized he would try to back out of it afterwards. I went up to his flat to try and drive some sense into him, but I was too late. The front door wasn't locked. He was slumped down in the chair with his pistol still in his hand. It was as though I was a murderer twice over.
And was there a note? A note which you took away?
It was to the coroner. He said he'd given perjured evidence and that the dead man was not Robert Underhay.
And you got rid of it, you bastard.
I was in too far to go back. I wanted the money so I could get Lynn away from you. And I wanted you to hang for the murder.
Too bad it all went wrong, wasn't it?
But what was all this mysterious woman business? How could she be in there talking to Arden when he was dead?
There was no woman.
But old Mrs. Ledbetter, you talked to her at the Stag. She saw her, she heard her.
And what did she see? She saw someone in trousers and a tweed coat whose heavily made-up face was encircled in an orange scarf. And what did she hear? A man's voice crying, "Get out of here!" Eh bien, it was a man she heard and a man she saw. A very ingenious notion. Was it not, Mr. Hunter?
What do you mean by that, Monsieur Poirot?
It is now to you I will tell a story. You came along to the Stag at about 9 o'clock with the money to pay off Arden, and what do you find? The body of the blackmailer lying on the floor with his head battered in. You realize at once you are in danger. But no one has seen you coming into the Stag, and you set off as fast as you can across country to catch the 9:20 back to London. But then you run unexpectedly into Lynn Marchmont, and you realize it is too late to catch your train.
I should have known. I saw the smoke of the train in the valley, but I failed to connect it somehow.
And when Mr. Hunter tells you it is 9:15, you simply accept it as a fact.
But what about the telephone call?
Ah, that involved an entirely new scheme, did it not, Mr. Hunter? You return to Farrow Bank and help yourself to a scarf of your sister's and her makeup. You go back to the Stag and go through your performance in front of the old lady.
Is this true, David?
I've always prided myself on my act as a female impersonator. And I left the lipstick.
But you rang me from London.
It was really very simple. You ring your sister at the flat from a public call box and tell her that at 11:04 exactly she must put through a call to Lynn Marchmont pretending to be the operator, and tell her that there is to be a call from London and she must first replace the receiver. And then, a moment later, you ring the Marchmont home, giving the impression that you are in London.
So that is why you rang me.
You're damn clever, Monsieur Poirot. You've pieced it together exactly.
But of course, I hadn't the faintest idea who could have killed Arden. As far as I could see, nobody had a motive except myself and Rosaline.
Motive. That has always been the difficulty. Every member of the Claude family had a motive for killing your sister, but it was not one of them that exchanged a sleeping powder for a deadly dose of morphine.
But I don't understand. Who...
This case has always been the wrong way round. She was killed by the person who had most to lose by her death. You killed her, Mr. Hunter.
But why should I kill my own sister?
You killed her because she was not your sister. Rosaline Claude died in the air raid that killed her husband, Gordon Claude. The woman you passed off as her and whom you callously murdered was a young Irish housemaid who survived the blast.
You're bluffing. I'm not going to listen to any more of this. Lynn, come with me now.
Her name was Eileen Corrigan. I received this photograph from her next of kin today.
But that's Rosaline.
Lynn, come now.
I can't. I can't.
Then I must take my chance.
I'll get him. He can't go far.
It's not true. It can't be true.
I am afraid that it is all too true, mademoiselle.
But how could he do it?
Imagine for yourself his feelings on the night of the Blitz. His sister dead and Gordon Claude dying. All that wealth and life of ease snatched away from him. And then he looks at the girl lying unconscious, the only survivor apart from himself, a girl roughly the same age as Rosaline, and whom he has probably already made his mistress. He has a way with women.
Yes. He has a way with women.
He snatches his chance of fortune. The only people who knew Rosaline Claude are dead, and her husband has not yet introduced her to his family. When Eileen Corrigan regains consciousness, he does not have much difficulty in cajoling her into taking on the role of his sister.
So that was why he hurried her off to London the moment Arden turned up in Walmsley Vale.
He could not risk him getting a sight of her in case he was under hay.
But why did he have to kill her?
Oh, the poor girl was beginning to give way under the strain of it all. Sooner or later she was bound to give the whole thing away. And there was another factor. You had come into his life.
And so he changed one of her sleeping powders for morphine.
He reckoned that no one would suspect him, for he had no motive. The death of Rosaline would mean that the money would pass back to the Claudes. That was his trump card. Everything about this case was always the wrong way round.
They've got him. You'd already tipped off the police, I take it?
Yes, I had warned them.
Did he say anything?
He said he'd had a good run for his money. He was a gambler, and he knew when he'd had his last throw.
There is a tide in the affairs of men, but the tide also ebbs, and it may carry you out to sea.
So what happens now? Giroli, I mean.
The police will no longer be looking for the killer of Enoch Arden, and I shall not enlighten them.
But what about Major Porter? I'm morally responsible for his death.
Oh, no, you're not. He could have turned down your proposition. He was just a weak character.
You see, already Mademoiselle is taking your side.
But I tried to strangle her.
I do not think you will do it again. You were blinded by jealousy. You could think of nothing but keeping the woman you loved.
I've been the most stupid, blundering fool, risking everything for a man I thought was dangerous and attractive. And he turned out to be a vicious murderer.
And what am I?
Oh, don't be pig-headed and melodramatic. If you have a row with a hulking big man and hit him and he falls down and he hits his head on a fender, that isn't murder.
It's manslaughter. I could go to prison for that.
Well, if you do, I should be waiting outside when they release you.
Bravo, mademoiselle. And now it is time for me to take my leave.
You are finally going back to London.
I have breathed deeply of the air of Walmsley Vale. I have been enchanted by the sweet smells of the countryside. But now I long to be back in town. I miss the gaiety of the shops and the restaurants and the bright lights of which we were so sadly deprived during the dark days of the war. And, rather to my surprise, I miss the smell of cigars and cognac and leather, the particular aroma of my club, where I first heard the tale of Robert Underhay. Who knows what I may hear there when I return?
In Agatha Christie's Taken at the Flood, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat. Superintendent Spence, Robert Lang. Lynn Marchmont, Susanna Corbett. Rowley Claude, Ivan Meredith. David Hunter, Tom George. Rosalind Claude, Fritha Goody. Adela Marchmont, Virginia McKenna. Francis Claude, Caroline Wilde. Jeremy Claude, Andrew Sachs. Kathy Claude, Elizabeth Proud. Lionel Claude, Johan Meredith. Major Porter, Derek Waring. Enoch Arden, Don McCorkindale. Mrs. Ledbetter, Mary Wimbush. Beatrice Lippincott, Becky Hindley. The Coroner, James Taylor. The Maid, Debbie Hunt. Taken at the Flood was dramatized by Michael Bakewell. It was directed by Enid Williams for BBC Radio 4 and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.